Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Hello and good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Happy Thursday. So glad you're with me this morning. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21 says, God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Chew on that all day long. 2 Corinthians 5, 21, God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. We've got a great show scheduled for today. Looking forward to it. We're going to be speaking to Luke Harrington in just a minute. He's going to be talking about understanding the history of Easter and the word Easter. And is that a pagan word? Where does that come from? Is that rooted in godless worship? The word Easter doesn't appear in the Bible. So we're going to talk to him in just a minute. He's from ChristandPopCulture.com. Then Kim Cattola is going to be with us from Cradle My Heart. And then in the second hour, Dr. Peter Capster should be in the studio with me. And then we're going to talk to my friend, Bible mentor and scholar, Jeff Verdorn. We're going to talk about what day was Jesus actually crucified. Was he crucified on Thursday or was it Friday? And how do we figure those 3 days and three nights in the tomb? Jesus' last message to his disciples were that just like Jonah being 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish, so will I be 3 days and three nights. So let's figure out the math on that. We'll see if we can't process that conversation. That's all in the second hour. But for now, let's take a little break. It's 6 minutes after the hour. When we come back, we will be talking to Luke Harrington. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the show. I have on our studio line Luke Harrington. He manages social media for Christ and Pop Culture and writes the column D-List Saints. He's with me this morning. We're talking about kind of a follow-up column to one he did around Christmas time about the origins of Christmas. And now we're here at Easter time, and there is also what we hear about as pagan origins of Easter, and we're here to talk about that with him. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning.
So we get around this time, usually some atheists and people, even maybe some fundamentalist Christians, that struggle with the word Easter. Is that an ancient pagan word?
The jury's kind of out on that. basically, what we do know for sure about Easter is that it was basically the name for the month of April in the ancient Anglo-Saxon language, which we would call Old English.
Okay.
There has been some theorizing that it comes from the name of a goddess named Yastre.
Mm-hmm.
But we have very little evidence, very, very little evidence that anyone ever worshipped a goddess named Yastre. What the evidence we do have is a single sentence from a work by a Northumbrian monk named the Venerable Bede, and I believe the 8th century mm-hmm. AD. And it's in a work that has otherwise nothing to do with her. And he just kind of mentions her offhand as, yeah, this month is named after her. And that's the only shred of evidence we have that anyone ever worshipped her. So,
you know, look, I'm wondering if the average person listening to the show as they're driving to work or getting ready even has the thought, is the word Easter even in the Bible?
Oh, of course not.
But I think there'd be probably a number of Christians that would be surprised to hear that.
You hear that the word Easter is not in the Bible?
Yeah, I bet there would be.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just saying that there's a lot of people that suffer from biblical literacy, and the average person go, well, yeah, Easter, that's a word in the Bible, isn't it?
And the answer would be no. And that's the funny thing about the English language is that we have kind of weird names for a lot of things. Mm-hmm. so we call the day that we celebrate the resurrection of Christ, we call that Easter. And in German, they would call it Ostern. But in nearly every other language, what you see people calling the holiday is some variation of Pesach, which is the Hebrew word for Passover. So in Spanish, for instance, I believe it's Pascha is the word for Easter. And so English and German are kind of weird, but if you speak any other Indo-European language, what you see is that Easter is, it's the Christian version of Passover, because, you know, traditionally Christians believe that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Passover lamb. And if you know the story of Passover, you know that it's the Exodus in Egypt when God says, I'm going to send my angel of death to kill the firstborn of the Egyptian children. But if you paint your door with lamb's blood, the angel will see the blood and he will spare your children. And early Christians obviously saw deep theological significance in this. They connected Jesus directly to the Passover lamb, partly because he had died around the time of Passover, but also partly because, you know, we have this real idea that Jesus died in place of us so that we would not have to die. So it's not clear in English, but Easter is the Christian Passover.
Mm-hmm. Luke, I want to see if I can't process some of the historical background of Easter. And so if it was this, if Easter, and did you pronounce that word Estore? How did you pronounce that?
Yastre. Believe is the preferred pronunciation.
Okay, Yastre. Yeah. And that's the name of an ancient pagan goddess of spring and fertility. And would that have the association with the bunnies and the eggs? I'm trying to figure this out here.
The reality is we don't really know where the bunnies and eggs thing comes from with any clarity. Nobody knows anything about Yastre. If anyone ever worshipped Yastre, nobody knows anything about her because all we have is a single sentence. that's the only evidence.
That's it, huh?
For. Yeah, and well, what you do see is Jacob Grimm of the Brothers Grimm, writing in the 19th century, he wrote pages and pages about Yastre or Ostara was the word he used for her because he was writing in German. And he wrote pages and pages about how she had this hare companion and stuff, but he was just making stuff up, you know? Or at the very least, he didn't cite a single source. So we don't know where he got any of this information. So he might, you know, he was either making stuff up or speculating or whatever. So we don't know where the bunnies and eggs thing comes from. If you want my opinion,
I do.
If you want my opinion, I just say bunnies and eggs are just a symbol of spring. You know, birds start laying eggs, bunnies come back because they're done hibernating. Of course, it's going to get associated with whatever holiday people are celebrating in spring. There's kind of this idea in the public consciousness that, oh, bunnies and eggs are this pagan fertility symbol, but I don't know which pagan religion used them as a fertility symbol. Like no one's been able to point to one for me. Anglo-Saxons did not use bunnies as a symbol for anything, you know, and Anglo-Saxons are the ones who supposedly worship Yastre. They didn't use bunnies as a symbol for anything. Anglo-Saxon symbology usually centers around birds. but If you want to talk early Christianity, there is kind of a history of using bunnies and eggs as symbols. There's a lot of early ancient Christian art that uses bunnies to symbolize Jesus or the Virgin Mary or the Trinity. And as far as eggs go, well, the traditional Lenten fast forbids eggs entirely. So it does kind of make sense that people would be celebrating eggs at Easter when they can finally eat eggs again.
Interesting.
and I don't know if that's like the definitive explanation for why bunnies and eggs are associated with Easter, but it's probably part of it.
Oh, that's real interesting, Luke. Let me take a little break. When I come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Luke Harrington. We're talking about some of the origins of the Easter traditions. We'll take a short break and be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I'm speaking to Luke Harrington. He is manages social media for Christ and Pop Culture and writes the column The List Saints. With me today talking about Easter and some of its origins and some of its pagan traditions. And Luke, I'm just kind of, again, I'm just poking around here, but how is it that we have come to continue to propagate that Easter is rooted in these pagan goddess worship? Is it the internet, or is it just tradition, or are we just uninformed and we don't set the record straight, or what do you think?
Yeah, well, I do think that last bit is part of it. What you see in fairly recent history in the last couple hundred years, especially around the time of the Enlightenment and the Romantic period, is just it was very, very popular to try to, you know, kind of dig up the secret pagan history of Europe, so mm-hmm. to speak. And that was, you know, some of the Grimm brothers were very big on. And it, you know, there were, that was kind of coming from two directions, though. There were kind of the quote unquote free thinkers who were trying to undermine Christian hegemony, but there were also a lot of Protestants who were trying to undermine the Catholic Church. So what you see coming out of history and philology for the last couple hundred years is a lot of speculation about, oh, this must be pagan, oh, this must be pagan. But if you dig into the primary sources, there's just not a lot of evidence for it. So, you know, I mean, we're talking, so these ideas that Christian holidays are like secretly pagan is actually a very recent idea. And there's not a lot of stuff, and there's not a lot of evidence in the primary sources that really bears it out.
Mm-hmm.
And what I tell people is, you know, there's no dichotomy. It's not like, okay, like everything in Christianity is pagan, or like nothing in Christianity is pagan. It's like, you know, after a certain point in history, all the new converts to Christianity were coming from a pagan background. So there's probably some, you know, quote unquote pagan traditions that have survived, but like, it's not like ancient Christians took all these pagan festivals and just said, oh, we're going to keep celebrating them. Let's paint this thin veneer of Jesus over them either, you know? And what we know about Easter, I mean, the evidence is all very much there. For people who are willing to dig into the primary sources. I had an atheist friend the other day who said, well, if Easter is really about Jesus, why is the date so weird? You know, why is it the first full moon after the spring equinox? What's that about? That sounds pagan to me. But it's like, it's not like keeping time with the sun and moon is like a uniquely pagan thing. Like everybody kept time with the sun and moon mm-hmm. in the ancient world. And if you, we actually have like a lot of direct evidence about why that date was chosen for Easter. Cause the date was chosen at the First Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, which the records from have been very carefully preserved. So the reason that that date was chosen was there was controversy of, should Easter follow Passover? Should we ask pagan, or should we ask Christians who are using the Julian calendar to try to follow the Jewish rabbinic calendar? Or should Easter fall on the day that Jesus actually rose from the dead? Or should Easter always fall on a Sunday because the theological significance of Sunday was seen as really important? So what they did was they kind of compromised between the rabbinic calendar, which is a lunar calendar, and the Julian calendar, which is a solar calendar. And they just said, okay, you know, we'll approximate the date of Passover by saying, wait for the spring equinox, then wait for the first full moon, and then we'll always celebrate it on a Sunday. You know, I mean, there are real explanations for these things. It's not some dark, mysterious pagan past that you have to imagine.
Mm-hmm. Luke, I love your curiosity. When did you get the bug to start studying church history?
Oh, man, that's a good question. You know, I was raised a pastor's kid, but my parents raised me Presbyterian, who are not at all big on celebrating holidays or digging into church history or whatever. But eventually, in my adulthood, I came around to sort of a high church Lutheranism, you know, which is much more connected to the past of the church. It was very helpful to me for my faith to see, you know, hey, Christians have always been around doing this stuff. you know, there are reasons for these weird traditions, mm-hmm. you know? So yeah, that's a it's been a passion for me. And, you know, I tell people I'm a humorist, not a historian. Like, the column I write is mainly for laughs.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have any credentials. I'm just a guy who likes to dig into the past and write funny articles that will hopefully inspire others to do the same.
And that is at, ChristandPopCulture.com?
ChristandPopCulture.com is the site, and the column is called D-List Saints.
Love it. So, Luke, what do you think some of the benefits of learning these stories in the church's history? I know that you've spent a lot of time poking around. So what are some of the benefits you can think of?
Yeah, well, the column, I kind of do. I've done specials at the last couple of holidays. The usual focus of the column is like weird or embarrassing or ugly stories from church history.
Uh-huh.
So usually I write about like the Crusades or like, you know, saints that screwed up.
Yeah. And plenty did.
You know, yeah, exactly. and so, I mean, my usual thing, my usual message is, hey, we've been this way before, guys. You know, we've always had problems with hypocrites and failures and sinners. You know, it's like, it's always been like it, the way it is now, you know? So don't, no matter how dark things are, don't lose hope.
Mm-hmm. And I'm a big fan of people like yourself that wants to, not take themselves too seriously and give people a chance to see the light side of stuff and to learn about things and then have a smile and a laugh along the way. I love that.
Thank you.
Work well done, my friend. Thank you so much for coming on to the show. It has been a delight to get to meet you, and congrats on your work, and happy Easter.
All right, you as well.
You bet. I've been speaking to Luke Harrington. You can go check out his work over at ChristandPopCulture.com. ChristandPopCulture.com. We'll take a short break and be back in just a minute.
Early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and one of the core listeners of the Early Morning Late Show on Faith Radio with Bill Arnold.
Good morning. It's 25 minutes after the hour. So if you become an Uber driver, do your friends stop asking you for a ride to the airport? Just curious. You never know, because I'm trying to learn how to say no, because I sometimes just have a hard time saying no. So a friend of mine said, can you give me a ride to the airport? I said, no worries. Yeah, no problem. So I got the word no in there a couple of times, so I'm working on it. I think I'm getting better at it. And if you are looking for an opportunity to watch the Early Morning Late Show live, you could do that April 17th. That's going to be happening just tax day, which is April 17th this year. So it's going to be an easy day to remember. But we're going to have a little open house here with a live broadcast of the show. You can come and have some rolls and coffee and watch the show from 7 to 8. We're just going to be 7 to 8 live. Isn't that right, Rebecca?
That is correct. Yes.
Yeah, but the show is going to be on from 6 to 8 like normal.
Yes.
But
we don't expect anybody to come at 6 o'clock.
Not at 6 o'clock. So I'll be broadcasting from 6 to 7, and
yes.
Then we'll go out to this really comfortable room where there'll be nice coffee and donuts probably, and then we'll have the live broadcast. You can come sit and watch it happen. How cool is that? And we're going to have some fun in-studio guests. I think people like Patrick Albanese from prestigious West Des Moines could be here. Peter Kaffner could be here. And who else did I threaten with?
George Frazier.
How did I forget George? George Frazier, he will definitely be here.
Never forget George.
I know that for a fact because he already said he'd come. So we're going to have a lot of fun. It's going to be a good time to meet some of the in-studio guests and get a chance to just be in some fellowship with some fun people. So that's going to be coming up April 17th. Mark it on your calendar or whatever you do. So it's going
to
be fun.
And if you'd like to come, you can register ahead of time just so we know you're coming. That way we know how much coffee to get and how many donuts. And you could do that at the website. So just go to the Early Morning Late Show page. Again, myfaithradio.com. Then look for Early Morning Late Show. And there's a little form on the right-hand side of the page that you can fill out and let us know you're going to come over and visit.
Right. Now, so far, one person has signed up. And I said to the staff, would it make more sense to try to get more people to come or just to try to talk that one person out of coming?
Odds are pretty even at this point.
I think so. So you think you're a popular show and then you realize one person signed up.
Well, didn't we already put in the order for the cinnamon rolls, though?
We did, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so everybody has to come.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of cinnamon rolls or something like that. Definitely have coffee with cream and sugar. And little stir sticks. So that's going to be a for sure, right?
Oh, I'm going to be there. So we've got to do the show.
But we're not going to be here in the studio. We're going to be in a room downstairs, which is going to be a nice room. I think it's room for about 60 people. So I think there's a cutoff. So hopefully we'll have a nice full house. But either way, we're going to have a lot of fun. And if you want to come and be part of that, we'd love to have you. And that is, again, April 17th, which is tax day. And I've been doing a lot of traveling lately, which is, of course, tax problems. But I know I will be there that day, and you can come and be part of that as well. I don't know if you electronically file your taxes or if you actually still put them in the mailbox. So we have a mailbox not too far from the University here of Northwestern, and you can actually put your taxes in the mailbox and come and sit through an hour of the Early Morning Late Show, which we would love to have you come.
We are here to serve.
We are here to serve.
Proximity to the mailbox included.
Yes, yes. So that is what is coming up. And that, again, is April 17th. Think about it. Consider it. We'd love to have you. So we've got a great show still ahead. We've got Kim Cotola coming up from Cradle My Heart. We're going to talk to her. And then we've got Dr. Peter Kapsner. And then Jeff Verdorn is going to be talking about the final week that Jesus was on earth. All ahead. Be back in a minute.
We're learning that there's hope.
Well, I am kind of a Susie addict. I'm trying to find some balance. And I love Liz's new program that we're listening to. I love to just be able to turn it on and hear her.
Well, I love Susie Larson's show, of course. Oh, she's just so honest, and I like her outgoing, being so outgoing, and she's a great person.
Connecting faith to life, together on Faith Radio.
Never interrupt banjo music. That's my theory. 25 minutes until the top of the hour, I have on our studio line Kim Cotola from Cradle My Heart. Good morning, Kim. Good morning. I think you're there.
Hello.
Hello, Kim. How are you?
Good morning. Hi. Hi, I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. And how are the grandkids?
We're all fine and
good.
Please don't speak so loudly because some of them are sleeping.
All right, we will do that. I don't think I have to whisper on my end, but you probably have to whisper on your end.
Everyone needs to whisper now all the time, Bill, if any baby is sleeping here.
All right, let's start with a little bit of outrage because this is something that I just I saw, and then it was a Pennsylvania branch of Planned Parenthood that put out a tweet that they have since retracted. But they said that Disney needs to have a princess who's had an abortion. We need a Disney princess who's pro-choice. We need a Disney princess who's an undocumented immigrant. We need a Disney princess who's actually a union worker or who's transsexual. There you go.
Well, okay, so all of these, yeah, you're right. This was a list on their tweet of what the social justice agenda du jour, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
that people need to get on board with supporting people who, I guess, fall under those labels, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that, I mean, okay, well, maybe we need to know that more women have actually had abortions. If that's what they're trying to say, I might on one level agree with them if they would be willing to tell the whole truth about those women and their lives. You know, because you may have looked at someone like me at age 25 and said, wow, you know, she's got her own radio show. She's really accomplished. You may have looked at me at 28 and said, oh, she's a career woman who's also married and expecting a child and raising a family. And you might have thought, you know, it's the American dream. She's the all-American girl. But that abortion in the past, Bill, put a pall over all of it for me. And even if a Disney princess were to have an abortion, I'm telling you, I'm here to tell you, there's not going to be a happy ending until she reconciles that spiritually and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
There's not going to be any sort of Disney plot line that can unfold for her good until she takes care of the fact that what she did was wrong, and until she repents and it comes to Jesus over it. I'm sorry to sound so stereotypically Christian, but women need to come to Jesus after abortion. And that's not something I say as a judgment or a condemnation. I say that as an offer of peace, because that's the only place you can find peace after abortion is in the arms of Jesus Christ. So, yeah, maybe we need a Disney princess who's had abortion. If Disney would tell that story of her journey back to peace,
right,
I'd be willing to shell out some money for girls to see that story. I think it would be a cautionary tale.
Right. Now, I assume I'm always a little naive, but I remember a time, and maybe this is me being naive, when Disney's job was to entertain, not to necessarily have an agenda where they were trying to persuade young kids. Do I have that wrong? Had they always had an agenda and I just missed it?
Well, the people with an agenda are the people who are running the Planned Parenthood who made that tweet, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, clearly they have an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, you know, it's the liberal laundry list of whatever their worldview represents. That, okay, their worldview is so opposed to the Christian worldview, Bill. You and I as Christians know that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Humankind needed a savior from sin. That's why Jesus came. We are basically totally depraved as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
The good news is Jesus Christ makes us new, right? That's the Christian worldview. But the liberal and godless worldview says, and I know there are some liberals who are believers, so please give me grace as I'm laying out these broad strokes. But, you know, the godless worldview, let's just call it that, says people are basically good. And what they need is a government to compel those who aren't to take care of all the rest, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we have a government that allows abortion, if we have a government that has no restriction on immigration, if we have a government that, you know, follows their agenda, then everyone will be good. And, of course, human nature isn't subject to governmental regulation. Human nature is human nature.
Mm-hmm.
And we need a savior, and we need redemption, and we need renewal. And so, yeah, you're right, Bill. Their entertainment is part of the agenda as to how those who want government to compel the good, they definitely need to recruit entertainment to change hearts and minds.
Yeah.
And they've been really effective at doing it, I guess, right?
Yeah. Well, I know Disney did take a little made an attempt with Beauty and the Beast remake, where LaFoe, I think, was kind of a gay character, or at least trying to say that he had this huge crush on Gaston. So I just wondered if that will continue to be what might companies like Disney are going to continue to do. Makes me curious.
Yeah, I haven't researched it to be able to really comment, but, you know, being around the edges of the story, I see that they are more interested in cultural relevance
mm-hmm.
than upholding traditional family values, it seems, right now.
Yeah. So, Kim, do you know what the update is on the fetal heartbeat bill in Iowa?
You know, very interesting that the sponsor of the bill, Representative Steve King, put on a Facebook Live video that I think is required viewing, because it really gives you a very good handle on how pro-life disagreement and infighting is costing human lives. He notes that, you know, the thing is not advancing as he would have it, because it has already cleared the Senate, but it's not advancing as he would have it. And part of the reason is because the National Right to Life Committee has not endorsed it. At this point, they're not openly opposing it, but they're saying they're neutral on it. Well, his Facebook video gives some very good context on this. And he talks about the fact that John Boehner, when he was the U.S. Speaker, said that any pro-life legislation would have to be endorsed by the Susan B. Anthony List, the Family Research Council, and the National Right to Life Committee. Those are the three largest pro-life organizations. Well, the Family Research Council and Susan B. Anthony List do favor heartbeat bills because they save lives if enacted. National Right to Life Committee has taken a more political stand on it and said, look, we don't want this going to the Supreme Court, which might make even harsher restrictions the result if they take another look at abortion given the current composition of the court. Well, Representative King says he's not interested in appeasing the current composition, and he referred to, you know, the aging members of the court and saying that, you know, in a year and a half, the court's going to look very different. And not only is this politically expedient, but this is the right thing to do. And when a heartbeat can be detected, which is at 6 weeks of pregnancy, we know that a human life is existing because there's a human heartbeat there. And so, you know, ethically protecting that life under the law should take precedence over trying to maneuver things politically at the Supreme Court level. And, you know, politically, he's pretty savvy as well, Bill, because he noted that, for example, when the partial birth abortion ban was being argued, it was struck down at three of the lower courts, but when it made its way to the Supreme Court, it was upheld. So I think that, you know, if you have a Facebook account, I would try and find this video and watch it from Representative Steve King and let your state representative know how you feel about it, because Iowa is out front with this bill, and it's got a pretty good chance at this point of passing.
I like it. Kim, let me take a little break. When I come back, we'll continue our conversation with Kim Cotola from Cradle My Heart. It is 15 minutes until the top of the hour.
There is a barber showing photographs of every head he's had the pleasure to know, and all the people that come and go stop and say hello. On the corner is a bank.
It's 13 minutes until the top of the hour. Kim Cotola is with me this morning. All right, Kim, here's kind of a fun story. This couple, lovebirds from high school, they have very little trouble getting pregnant. They just can't seem to hang on to them. So they've had miscarriages, and they do a very low-dose treatment of fertility, and they find out they're pregnant, finally, again. And this time, they're pregnant with six babies.
This is such a great story. Courtney and Eric Waldrop have sextuplets.
Yeah.
And, yeah, they were hoping for one more baby. They already had twins, as you said, and an older boy.
Uh-huh.
And so selective reduction was offered to them, Bill, because this is what happens when you go through fertility treatment. Couples go hoping to get pregnant with a baby, and then the fertility experts say, oops, we have six babies, you should reduce. Now, that's very clinical to say selective reduction. What mm-hmm. does that mean? That means going into the pregnancy with an injection of digoxin to the heart of the baby that you're selectively reducing to bring about fetal demise, to kill them in utero. And you know, to their credit, the Waldrops said absolutely not. And even though, you know, with trouble carrying a pregnancy to term, she had many miscarriages. I think you noted that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's placing herself at risk, but they said it was their faith that would not allow them, first of all, to do a selective reduction, but also she said we would never consider that. But with the risks involved, no doctor could sugarcoat what could happen. There were very real risks for her and for the six babies. They have three girls and three boys. And by the way, today, those babies were born in December. They're early. Their lungs weren't developed, so they all needed to be on oxygen. But I think they're all home now and all off the oxygen. Three boys, three girls. They have nine kids.
Oh! That's a big jump from three to nine all of a sudden.
Big jump. But they said, you know, we are strong in our faith. And she said, you never know how you're going to feel till you're in those shoes, but we turn it all over to God, including the fears. And he said the risks, Courtney said, the risks and the fears, all of it were just, the burden of it was lifted. And so here they are. And it's such an encouraging story. You know, when couples face dire diagnoses or risky pregnancies. No, we can't judge how they're feeling and what they're going to do, but it's so encouraging when they go forward in faith and when faith remains strong regardless of the outcome, because sometimes, of course, there isn't a healthy baby. Sometimes those risks prove to be, you know, something that families do have to face and have to face consequences. But in this case, it was a really beautiful story and one that really encourages all of us, I think.
Kim, I would say that this is the first time I've heard the term selective reduction. Is this a newer term? I'm not saying that it's new because I'm just hearing about it, because that doesn't surprise me at all. But what about our listeners? Are they hearing that, do you think, for the first time, or has this term been around for a while?
For me, this is the other edge of the spear on abortion, because, right, we are told that poor women need abortion because, it, you know, children will ruin their economic future, right? On the other end of the spectrum, you have couples that can afford fertility treatment and can afford to fully do all of the planning to make the perfect family. They go through the fertility treatment and now, we weren't planning on triplets. So the doctors say, well, you know, to protect your upper income, you're going to have an abortion of one or two of these triplets. And it's the 2-1 pregnancy was written about in the New York Times a number of years ago. And, you know, it's difficult for these parents because here they are, Bill. They wanted children. Now they have a viable pregnancy and they're going to kill the children that they worked so hard to conceive. I mean, if this isn't a recipe for emotional distress and for some sort of spiritual fallout in the aftermath, I don't know what is. And so selective reduction only affects, it doesn't happen in very many facilities because the procedure itself is very risky. The New York Times, again, wrote about the Mount Sinai Medical Center where a woman can get a reduction. And they are only about 100 cases a year, you know, so it's not common. It's absolutely not common. But the stories do illustrate for us what the thinking that any woman can decide whether a child should live or die, where that takes us, you know, and the burden that that places on women who are being told by their doctors, oh, yes, you now have three babies you can reduce and only have one should you so decide. These are horrible, horrible ethical dilemmas to lay on the shoulders of individual women. And I don't really have all the answers. I guess I'm just here to maybe continue to sound the alarm that we need to pray that God would break through in these situations. And we need to pray that we as a society would not forget the children as we advance in what we're able to do to help families plan.
Kim, I'm thinking about this, and if a woman decides she does want to be a mother, but she doesn't want to be a mother to as many growing children in her womb as she has, She's going to, in her head, say, I'm going to eliminate some of them. I'm just trying right. to, I'm having a hard time with this, but I have a hard time with a lot of this stuff. So it's not like you're taking grocery items out of the cart that you can't afford to pay for.
Right. And of course, you know, the fertility treatment specialists, as well as those who are in favor of selective reduction as an ethical proposition, they talk about selective reduction to build families. Again, this is
wow.
crazy thinking.
That's
You're
crazy.
Not building anything by destroying a life, right? And our hearts will find us out when we buy into that, that euphemism can never comfort your soul in the dark of the night. Euphemism will always expose itself as a deception. And stigma isn't the answer, Bill. But, I think it's very interesting to note that even abortion supporters, many of them, are very much against selective reduction. Slate magazine or Slate.com featured an article from William Salatin, and he said, you know, this is selective reduction provokes discomfort from even the staunchest abortion rights proponents who say they have qualms with the reduction decision because it's really now a very complicated ethic. It's very different than one woman deciding to end the life of one child with an individual abortion. Women who undergo fertility treatments end up half aborting, right, sometimes if they reduce a twin. Well, a half abortion still takes the life of a complete and individual
mm-hmm.
being. So, yeah, Bill, it's as I say, it's really the tip of the spear. And it really makes us stand back and say, simply because we can do something, should we?
Yes, I agree. Kim, now, I'm curious, have you had Jennifer Christie, the pro-life speaker, on your show? And if not, I hope you can get her soon.
No, I'm not aware of Jennifer.
Jennifer Christie, and you need to Google this and see her Facebook Live little speech she gave at the Iowa State. She was raped on a business trip, and she rejected abortion. And it's one of the most powerful speeches you'll hear about the survivor of sexual violence. She said, stop calling my son a rapist child. He's my son, and he has a right to be here. She got pregnant and had the baby. She's got a four-year-old son right now. It's so powerful. Jennifer Christie is her name, so you're going to have to look that up. But
well, thank you for the hat tip. I appreciate it, Bill, because you're right. These stories are the stories we need to hear. These stories are the stories we need to celebrate.
Yeah, maybe we can tweet that out, can we, Rebecca? We can. So if you just go to the Twitter feed, you should be able to find it. It's 3 minutes, and it's heart-stopping. It's so powerful. Well, Kim,
awesome.
Yeah, blessings on your Easter. Thank you for being such a great regular guest of the show and the work you do. I cradle my heart. Just love you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill. Happy Easter to everybody at Faith, too.
Yep, bye-bye. It's 4 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a very short break and be back. Thanks to Kim Cotola. Really a great hour. Luke Harrington. If you want to check any of that out, go to myfaithradio.com. If you want to hear any of the interviews or if you missed any part of it, you can go check it out there. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we've got Dr. Peter Kapsner in studio already. And he's got a special guest with him today. Probably won't bring her on the air, but just to let you know she's here. Be back in a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.